We are going to have our third speaker now. Please help me welcome Hella R. from Winchester VA.
Hi everyone. I'm not using the microphone either. Woo. My name's Hella, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. And I love alcoholics, so it's all good. I got to Al-Anon January 2005, and So I've been here a little while. Hope to be here a lot longer. I'm going to say a quick prayer before I start, just because, I mean, I've already prayed up, but this will help settle me down. God, help me to set aside everything I know and everything I think I know about myself, you, everyone in this room, my purpose for being here, and help me to be an agent of your will, not my own. Help me to remember that I am no longer running the show and make it impossible for me to get in your way. Amen. Like I said, I got to Al-Anon in 2005 against my better judgment. I had no interest in being there. Up until that point, everything I had decided to do, I accomplished. And I just decided I was going to do something, and I just did it. And I just barreled through whatever it was without any major problems. So I thought I was pretty invincible. But I came up against alcoholism, and it was bigger than me, and it was stronger than me, and it brought me to my knees. But thank God for that, because if that hadn't happened, I don't know that I would be standing here today. I grew up in a family deeply affected by alcoholism on both sides. My extended family is full of alcoholism. My parents themselves were not drinkers, but they were raised by alcoholics, their aunts and uncles, their siblings, alcoholics or drug addicts. But it's not like you would have known that. And that was the insidiousness of this disease, because you didn't look like it. They didn't act like it. They seemed like normal people, and they were very concerned about presenting a very normal, very healthy, well, I don't even know about healthy, actually, but a very normal image to anyone outside of the four walls of our home. And so they also didn't talk about anything. They didn't express anything. And I understand all of that now, but that's what I grew up in. I didn't grow up feeling very well loved, because they didn't know how. I mean, they didn't know how. They were surviving, but they looked like they had it all together. So it was very confusing. I got messages like, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Okay. If you just don't talk about it, it's not really happening. Okay. Don't think about it too hard. You might think of some things you don't like. So just, basically the message was, no matter what you're feeling, don't express it and just keep going. And, you'll be fine. And I'm like, okay, I'm not really sure how that works. So I felt always like the oddball, because I had all these feelings and I was always very dramatic as a result, because there was no way to express them. So usually it came in the form of like an extreme outburst of like, I would throw everything, just clear all the shelves in my room. And like, I've broken a lot of TV remotes, which is really annoying when you then have to want to change the channel. You got to get up now because you broke the remote again. But, right, so like every so many months, I would just have this outburst of irrational, disconnected, like crazy. And it's because I would just stuff it down because I didn't know how to talk about it. Part of my story is also that there was abuse, which I'm only just really unpacking now. And so that's in there. And I only share that so that if that's part of your story, just to let you know, like, it's okay and it wasn't your fault. But so my solutions to all of these things were pretty, drastic. So in the sense that I would just sort of quietly, put my head down, like, okay, well, I guess I just shouldn't stand out in any way because I don't want to cause a stir because I'm the weirdo who, like, has feelings and, like, might cry, and that's not acceptable. So at some point in my life, around 13, 14, I decided that, the solution was to basically will myself to not breathe. And what that was, they all thought, oh, she's got really bad asthma. And I was like, yeah, that's a good cover story. And so I would literally hyperventilate and that's how I remember it. I would sort of throw myself into a state and then I would essentially kind of pass out, but I would stop myself from breathing. That's a lot of self-will, let me tell you, because we breathe sort of like involuntarily all the time. But I was like, oh, I got to control this. And so that was where I first learned that I could control something pretty major that would seem impossible to control. And so I would do that. I would, if I was in a situation that was really difficult for me or I couldn't handle it, I would just breathe myself into a state of like an asthmatic incident, and I would, the ambulance would have to come. And the added bonus to that was like, now I'm getting all the attention. All the attention that I wasn't getting, all the love and care that I felt I needed, that I wasn't getting from my family. Well, now suddenly everybody's on site. Everybody's huddled around the hospital room. Everybody's there and very concerned and like, ooh, what's happening with her? And so I was like, oh, this is really kind of awesome. Like, I can manipulate my way through these people to get what I need or what I feel like I need so much. The other part was that they, my parents did go to church every week and they took me with them and I would sort of like begrudgingly go. And I remember around the same time where I started doing this whole weird breathing, not breathing thing, I made a decision and I was in church and I said, God, I just don't feel you. I don't know what you are. I don't understand this. And so I made a decision right there that I was like, you know what? I don't need your help because you're kind of useless to me. And I'm going to just take control here and do it my way. And so I'm like, so things like, yeah, I'm just not going to breathe and like pass out. Like, that's my version of taking care of myself and taking, my will. And so, the other big message I got, my parents had moved from Germany to the States and with my brothers. And at that point, my mom was happy to leave because, alcoholism. And she decided that, well, if we move to America, like, there's fewer bars. And so I don't know how that really worked out. But there's less bars there, so my kids won't become alcoholics. Like, her whole mission on some level with her children was to find a way to manage and control so that her children would not become alcoholics. And so that was a great geographic cure that didn't really work out. My oldest brother isn't really a drinker, but my second oldest brother, his drinking bothers me, let's put it that way. I don't know if he's an alcoholic. He doesn't call himself an alcoholic, but his drinking certainly bothers me. Actually, with him, ironically, his not drinking bothers me way more than when he's drinking. When he's drinking, he's super fun to be around. When he is not drinking, he's very cranky. So I'm like, please have a drink. anyway, so so that's kind of like what I was equipped with. Don't talk about it. If you don't talk about it, it's not happening. Make sure you present well. Make sure nobody knows what's really going on. So you can't be talking about nothing. And, you got this, and you can, by sheer force of will, control even whether or not you breathe. Okay, so I was like sort of sent off into the world with these skills. The sort of last thought my mom gave me before I left the house, I went to boarding school and then college, was just whatever you do, don't marry an alcoholic. Okay. I'm not really even sure what she meant by that. I'm like, well, how do I know if the person's an alcoholic? I mean, like, how do I identify this person so I cannot marry them? And so, you know, in my mind, I was like, well, okay, maybe it was from a movies or somewhere. I was like, well, clearly it's the guy or gal who's, like, got a brown bag and a something in there and is, like, maybe under a bridge or somewhere. I don't know, like, on a park bench, like, drinking in the middle of the day. That's what I thought. Oh, I'm like, well, yeah, I'm not going to marry that guy. you know, I mean, duh. Where would I meet him? So I decided like, well, this is easy. I can avoid marrying an alcoholic, no problem. So I moved to New York from Virginia where I grew up, and I get to New York, and you know, again, sheer force of will, I had a plan, and people were talking about plans early. I'm like, yeah, I had plans, and I just went after my plans, and I was making my plans happen, and I was working as a events planner, and I was planning this event, and like this guy walks in with a like cool leather coat jacket and exploding Q-tip hair, like it was bleached blonde, like Guy Fieri style hair, and I was like, whoa, I mean, who's that guy? That guy is pretty dope, so I must meet this guy immediately. Because my other plan was I'm going to go to New York because that's where all the weirdos are. In my mind, I'm a weirdo, so I need to go find me some other weirdos, countercultural types, people who don't fit in, misfits and so on. And then I'll blend in with them and, like, you know, I can just sort of, like, stand next to the crazy and, like, let them do all the work for me, and I can just really enjoy all the adventure and fun and excitement, but not really get in any trouble. And, like, I can be like, oh, yeah, it wasn't me, and, like, step aside and be like, oh, that's all these people over here. So I was like, this is great cover for me. So, and there's a lot of people in New York, so I'm like, there's a lot of cover. So, you know, because before that I was busy telling everybody how to live their life. So I'm like, I'm going to, you know, I got a whole bunch of people now I can manage and control. So because really what that was about is I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. I was so ill-equipped to deal with anything that I ever felt or thought. I never talked about it with anyone. I didn't know how to do that. I wasn't, so I just sat, like it just all sat and got stuck in there, and I just wandered around like a big uncomfortable mess who looked like she had it all together, right? Looked like I had the part, played the part perfectly. It's a great actress, apparently. But nobody knew. Like, nobody knew how, like, just empty, lonely, and really, really sad I was. Because I didn't tell you. So I was all about, like, I'm going to surround myself with people who would take the heat off me. And they could just be, like, my cover. So I see this guy. I'm like, I must meet him immediately. And I must make him promptly my boyfriend. And then, you know, and so I did. Because I had a plan. And I was going to, you know, I had actionable items. And so one of the first things was that night, he asked me, like, do you have anything stronger to drink back there? Because all they were serving is white wine. And I'm like, sure, I got vodka. And he's like, great. So I went back to this secret stash that I always had around somehow. I was like, always prepared. If you need the booze, I got the booze. I'll make you happy. And so I come back with this enormous tumbler of straight vodka, and he just shotguns that down. And I was like, oh, my God, that is amazing. Like, that is so amazing. What an incredible human. And so, like, how did he do that? And so I was like, well, this guy, definitely boyfriend material, so let's work on that. So I did, and, you know, then, you know, I was like, oh, I think you should totally move in with me. He had some stuff going on in his life. It wasn't going so well. I'm like, oh, come live in my apartment, which is really too small for that, but come live here. Here's my credit card, my bank card. Here are the keys. Like, let's go, right? Let's do this. We're going to make a house. He was like, okay. I'm like, please keep drinking. You're not really paying attention. I can tell you what to do. Like, this is wonderful. I'll drink with you. This is wonderful. I can drink with you. I can drink you drink for drink. I will hang in there with you. Because that's where you're at. So that's where I want to be. So then, you know, at some point into, you know, living together, then my dad passes away, which was... at the time, I was ill-equipped for. I was getting a master's degree, and then, you know, I was very close to him, and when he passed away, I just whatever was left that had not been shut down, that just, like, it just, the barn doors came crash, like, the heaviest steel door just crashed down, and I was like, that's it. Like, I made a decision right then and there in that moment that I no longer wanted to live. And so I was going to live for the guy. And I was going to make sure the guy did all the living for us so that I could sort of, like, take credit, but also, like, I didn't have to do any of the work, and he would do all of it for both of us, which that's the thing about, you know, the family disease of alcoholism, and when you're affected by alcoholism, it's, you know, you make these decisions, and you... for me, like, I didn't think enough of myself. I didn't, for all of my clear planning and execution on planning, I just didn't think I had it in me. I didn't think I had enough of worth to give to anyone else. And so I needed someone else to represent those things. But what I didn't realize is that in doing that, I was going to try and form this separate human into the image of what I wanted them to be, whether they wanted to be that or not. And so it was all focused elsewhere. And that's the thing about the family disease. You know, it's like I'm trying to manage and control everything that's outside of me, and I'm never looking at myself because I don't know how to do that. I'm scared to do that. I don't know what I might find in there. And even if I found it, I don't know that you could handle it. And so, like, let's just not do that. And let's just not do that. That's a bad idea. So all these other things seem like great ideas. So my dad passes away. I make this decision again. You know, okay, I don't need God, and now all I need is him. But I don't know, like, I need him to be a certain way. That's the key, right? Well, he was not playing along. So then I'm like, we must get married. And here's where you're going to get me my ring. And, you know, and then when he came to me, like, 6 months before the wedding, and he was like, listen, I can't do this. This is not for me. I really cannot do this. I pulled up a bar stool, and I spent the whole night talking to him and convincing him that, in fact, he could do this. And by the time the morning came, I think just to have me stop talking, he was like, okay, fine. And the reason wasn't necessarily because, oh, I love you so much. It was because the invites had gone out, the dress had been purchased. Like, what will all these other people think if I say wedding's off? So we get married, and the alcoholism progresses. But at some point in the proceedings, I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to keep drinking drink for drink. And, I'm getting older. I need to get serious. And so I was like, that was fun. But now, you know, I'm not really drinking. But he's not stopping. He's drinking more and doing all kinds of other things besides drinking. And I'm like, dang. And so I try all the things that had worked so far. I want to talk to him. I want to talk to him some more. I'm going to tell him again. I'm going to explain this one more time. I'm going to give him a solution. I'm going to tell him to go there. I'm going to tell him to do this, right? Meanwhile, it's getting out of control. And so now I'm getting mad. I'm really mad because He's not listening to me. He's not doing the things I'm telling him to do. He is not following directions. And it's not looking good. Like, this doesn't look good. Like, people are noticing. They're like, oh, this guy's crazy. Oh, you know. And I'm like, we cannot have this. This is not good public relations, my friend. We were in the entertainment business, and I was literally his manager and publicist, which... You know, that was ill-advised, but and we would go on tour and like travel the world, and you know, we would have a routine where like we would get somewhere, he would be drinking immediately, he would get drunk, we would get into a fight, it would be loud, it would be all night long, we would be like, we're gonna get a divorce, screw you, this whole thing's terrible, and then by the time the morning came, we were like, well, anyway, gotta go do the show, so let's put the divorce on hold, and we would do, like, rinse, wash, rinse, repeat, over and over and over again, in all kinds of, like, foreign locations. You know, we would... have people in our little tiny shoebox apartment in New York, and had no shame. Like, I was like, weirdly not trying to hide the reality of what was going on here and like the insanity. So this is one of my favorite stories that just sort of exemplifies, you know, where it kind of gets to. And it's sort of funny, but like also you're like, huh, interesting. So, so we had this bathroom that was like, you know, in a small New York apartment. The bathroom's basically in the kitchen and the living room. And like, it's like, that's like, it's like right there. So you really don't have a lot of privacy. Well, the doorknob broke off. And so we were like, oh, you know, just whatever. There's no doorknob, whatever. We didn't care. And then the next thing I know, like we had people coming over for a dinner party. I'm not really sure how we did that, but so they come over. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no doorknob there. And that's not good because people are coming over. So we had a box of clementines sitting there. And so we just took one of them and stuck it in the doorknob hole because that was now like at least there had privacy. So you know, then instead of, like, then the clementine got moldy because, you know, it's an organic thing. And then, you know, at some point I just switched that with a new one. Because I'm like, you know, I'm not going to go get a doorknob. I mean, that would actually make sense. So, you know, so a missing doorknob, there was a hole from one of our big fights, like, that he had punched in the wall. Didn't bother putting even a piece of art over that. Whatever, look at us, we're crazy. So, you know... Like, on the one hand, I was like, this is kind of cool, like, we're the crazy zany people, and at the same time, I was still trying to manage this, because it was, I got scared. I'm like, I'm genuinely scared, and I'm really more scared that he's going to die. I'm terrified he's going to die, but I didn't say any of that to anybody, and instead, I just had all this resentment, and suddenly, this person that I loved so much, I just had nothing but anger and resentment for, because I was powerless, because I couldn't fix it, and I was trying so hard. So what was, you know, and that's the sort of the progression of the family disease of alcoholism, is that that same powerlessness feeling comes over me, and I just am in a state of rage and resentment, because I'm like, if you only... dot, 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 then dot, 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 right? So if you would just not take that one more drink, then we could be happy. If you just, you know, didn't talk to me like that, then we would be happy. Like, it's you. Like, you need to stop doing whatever you're doing, because then we can be okay. And, it, you know, I didn't understand that I was getting increasingly really sick. So, you know, kind of went on like this for a while. And then at some point, he got sober. And so I was like, oh, okay. And he gets sober, and now he's, like, going to meetings all the time, and he's got a sponsor, and, you know... I'm thinking, oh, great, like now he's not doing those things anymore. I'll be happy. I was more unhappy because now he's getting better. He's like over here with people in recovery in AA, And I'm still, like, I'm still doing my favorite activity at the time, which whether he was drinking or not drinking, I would sit on the sofa and just sit there and wait. Hours of my life were spent sitting on a sofa, waiting, wondering, where is he? Worrying, is he okay? Whether he was drinking or not drinking, it didn't matter. Like, I just sat there, worrying for hours, waiting to hear the key in the door, or right, or getting a text or something. So I was like, wow, I'm still crazy. And now I'm like, this didn't fix, like, his not drinking didn't fix anything for me. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll just follow him around to AA meetings. Because I didn't, you know, I'd heard there was this thing called Al-Anon, and I was like, I don't want to go there. Those people are boring. Like, what's wrong with these people? I want to go to the AA people. They're much more fun. So I would go to AA meetings with him. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to sit here. Because also, so it was several reasons. One, I could make sure he was going, because I was still all about him. I make sure he's going. Then I can hear him share. And I was like, oh, this is very informative. I'm like, this is what's going on in his head. Because, right, because of alcoholism, in me, in him, my stuff, like, we didn't talk about anything. It's not like we, like, shared with each other about stuff. You know, usually it was like he would sort of talk for an hour straight, and I would just, like go sideways and listen, but like we weren't actually talking to each other, right? And the only way we would like have real passion in our dialogue was if one of us was in the other person's face, and we, you know, eventually one of us would hit the other. Like I definitely like did a lot of kicking and hitting, and then he would dish it back. So I'm like, oh, that was probably a bad idea, because he's a little bigger and stronger than I am. So that's not a good plan, but that's how we knew how to relate to each other. So I was like, if I go to these AA meetings, though, I can hear what's really going on with him. And then at some point, his sponsor came up to me and was like, lady, please, for the love of God, go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I was like, hell no, you're not my sponsor. And he was like, please, please, please go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I didn't right away, but that stuck in my head. And so at some point, you know, he was sober. Then he was not sober, and then he was sober again. You know, he relapsed a bunch of times over the course of, like, 7 or 8 years. And so at some point, you know, I was like, all right, I think I'm going to go check this Al-Anon thing out. So I go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I sat there, and I was completely horrified. Because these people were talking about things we should never say out loud in public. Like, this is unbelievable. How are you crazy? Like, why would you say all those things to perfect strangers? Like, I couldn't, like, my head was like, head explode. Like, I couldn't process, like, why would you say those things out loud in front of other people? Like, why would you admit to those things? How can you share those crazy thoughts you're having with a room full of people? You people are insane. And I was like, oh, hell no. So, but for some reason, I came back the next week. And I sat there for probably 6 months, and I would get there right before the meeting started, and I would leave right after the serenity prayer, and I just made sure that, like, you didn't actually get a chance to talk to me, and I definitely wasn't going to let you hug me. Like, no. So, you know, I was like, uh-uh. And I would sit in there, and I couldn't talk. I could not form words. I couldn't speak. I was so bad off. I was so shut down. I couldn't formulate a sentence. And I would just sit there and cry for, like, a good 6 months. And then, you know, I sort of had a sponsor for, like, 5 minutes, but then she kind of disappeared. That's how I remember it. And so I kept going to Al-Anon meetings. I went to Al-Anon meetings for 2 years, and I just went to one meeting a week, came in at the last minute, left before you could hug me, like, just, you know, low profile. Then I chaired the beginners meeting because I was like, well, it seems like a good idea. So, you know, I'm just like a lunatic lady with leading a beginners meeting. I'm like, well, at least it makes me get here. And so I was sitting there for, like, 2 years, and he was getting sober again, and then, and I was like, God, I am so miserable, because I would go to bed at night, and I would pray. I was like, I didn't even believe there was a God at this point. I was like, God, if you exist, if you are actually there, please do not let me wake up tomorrow. I can't do this anymore. I cannot get up one more day and walk through this earth. I can't. I got nothing left. I am burnt. And then I would wake up in the morning. I'd open my eyes, and I was like, ugh. I'm still here. This is not good. And I would go through the day, but I was like a zombie. It was like the zombie apocalypse. Like, there's me, like, just sort of walking through life, showing up, high performing, but completely, there was nothing in there, not a thing. And so I go to my regular meeting. This was now in Brooklyn, and I'm sitting there, and it's the anniversary meeting, and this lady starts sharing. She has like a few minutes to share because it's her anniversary, and she has like 7 years or something. And she tells the story of what it was like and what she grew up like, and I'm just like, oh my God, that's really horrible. Because see, in my mind, like, my story wasn't that bad. Like, the way I grew up was actually okay. I hadn't really figured out how bad it was or like what it had done to me. So I'm like, you know, oh wow, this lady has a really terrible story. Like, the things that happened to her are so terrible. And yet there she was, like, laughing and smiling, and like the energy coming off of her was incredible. And she was talking about her sponsor and like her steps. And I was like, oh my God, like, whatever that lady has done to go from where she was to where she is now, I want that lady to help me get there. Like, I'll listen to her. So I, like, at the end of the meeting, you know, I, like, literally, like, elbowed people out of the way. I'm like, get out of the way, people. I got to get to this. Like, she's, like, my savior here. So I, like, barrel through the crowd, and I, like, get to her, and I'm like, will you be my sponsor? And she was like, here's my number. Call me tomorrow. We'll talk about what we're going to do. And I was like, okay. So I call her the next day. She tells me, get a home group. Get a service position in that home group. Get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to study the steps out of there. And you're going to go to 3 meetings a week. And you're going to call me every day. Okay. So, you know, she was a busy lady. And so a lot of my recovery was, like, finding where she was and being wherever the hell that was. So, like, she was on the subway. She lived 2 stops from my house. She'd be on the, she's like, well, I'll be on the subway tomorrow at 7:30 in the morning going to work if you want to hitch a ride. I'm like, and I didn't have to get in the subway, but I was like, oh, I'm getting on the subway. So, like, I would meet her on the station. We would do recovery work on the subway. A few times I would start crying. Some guy would give me his napkin from his egg sandwich bag. And I was like, ew, this is really stinky. But I was like, whatever. Like, it's New York. No one cares. I won't ever see these people again. So, like, I'm like crying, like, we're doing step work, like, I'm like, he did this, and he said that, and this and that, and right. And she was like, what about you? 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 I'm like, stop asking me about me. It's very irritating. I don't know what to say to you about me. That's the truth. It was annoying because I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I like. I don't know what I want to wear. I don't know what I want to eat. I don't know anything about me. I don't know. I can tell you all about him. What he is like, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what he should do, what he shouldn't do. I don't know about me. Please stop asking me about me. But she was relentless. We, like, blew through the steps. 1, 2, 3. Middle of my 3rd step, the first time around, he came home and was like, yeah, I don't think I can do this anymore. I think I gotta go. And this time, instead of going, hold on, and, like, talking to him for, like, 24 hours straight and convincing him he should stay, I simply said, well, now that you've said that, you need to go. What? I knew then that this something had changed, because I knew that in my own strength, my will was, that was not my will. That was something else. And so, you know, we separated for 1.5 years, And I just followed that sponsor all over the place. We went here, there, and everywhere. This Al-Anon thing, this AA thing, this conference here, this service there. You know, I was a GR, intergroup rep, group rep, intergroup board member, treasurer, coffee maker, chair setter upper. I did every service position and then some. I made up a few, I'm sure. I just was like a service maniac. Like, I was all over the place. I would go to this one's house and make her food. I would go to this one's house and clean out her closet. I would have this one come over and, like, scrub my floor. Like, we just, like, right, was, like, service crazy. But you know what? I didn't sit on that couch. I didn't sit on that couch and worry. I didn't sit on that couch and ponder life. I was out busy running around, and maybe, okay, maybe a little much, maybe a little extreme, but I was out, and I was talking to people, and I made friends, and I had a life. I had a life of my own. It wasn't his friends, his life. It was my life. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, and I had to practice things like hanging out with friends and not talking about anything heavy. I was like, what? What? I mean, you, what? Like, and not talk about him. My sponsor, like, why don't you just talk about, like, makeup? And I was like, makeup? I don't wear makeup. She's like, well, I don't know. Talk about it. Ask people questions. I'm like, okay, fine. This is the dumbest subject I've ever heard of, in my opinion, but fine. And so I learned how to talk about nothing. I learned how to talk about goofy stuff that, you know, normal people apparently talk about all the time. That wasn't heavy. I didn't have to be like, oh, my soul is so heavy, you know, oh, the burdens of my mind, you know, like, no, like, hey, what kind of lipstick do you like? What kind of shoes have you got on? You know, like, whatever, like, random, like, easy, funny, light-hearted things. She's like, keep it light, keep it light. So I learned how to keep it light. I learned how to talk about nothing. We did get back together, and, you know, it wasn't, you know, it hasn't always been easy, and, you know, we had to learn how to talk to each other in a loving way, and not flip out, not punch walls, not punch each other, not kick each other, not say mean, horrible, nasty things. And I really got to practice and learn how to be sweet. And that's because people in the meetings, my sponsor, my fellows, like, would just hug me. And I mean, I remember standing there like, oh my God, like a surfboard, like, like, so, like, this is so uncomfortable. Please don't touch me. And they would just hug me. And I was like, oh my God, I think I'm going to die. But, you know, she said, let them hug you. So I did. I mean, I, you know, I cannot say enough about amazing sponsorship, the importance of a sponsor. And I can't tell you enough how much the gift of desperation, that desire to not want to live, and I know to this day that without this program, I will go right back there. Like, that is how I, this is the last stop on the train for a lady like me. Like, I won't do well on my own. I know that. So, like, no matter what's happened or doesn't happen, I will, this is the one thing I've done consistently for 15 years straight, without fail, not perfectly, and not always honestly. But I have just, I just kept coming back. And I just, whatever my sponsor asked me to do, I've done it. I just, she never told me what to do about my life or what decisions to make, but she gave me directions. Read this step, do this writing, go to that meeting, talk to that person, right? Like, she would, if she didn't have experience with it, she'd tell me who to call. And I just did that. Call five people. Call them just to say hi. See how their day is. Don't talk about you. Okay, I just did whatever she asked me to do. And I've had a couple of sponsors since. And my sponsor right now is in Atlanta. I'm in Virginia. And she's an amazing lady. And I do. It's the same. It's the same now as it was in the beginning. And if I didn't have that, I mean, you know, it's like that's the program. And then there's the fellowship. And there's a lot that I need in both of those places. But they're two different things, but I need them both. And sometimes I have more of the other, and it's a little out of balance, but that's okay because I'm still in the middle of the boat. And that's the one thing I can say, like, has helped me stay relatively sane. But the one thing that I didn't really appreciate, or I didn't realize, or I couldn't admit to until this last year, was how hard I still was. I was still very hard, and the hardness was really because I was still hiding a lot of secrets. I mean, I have done a lot of inventories. I've written a lot of four steps. I've done a lot of writing assignments, and there were some really key things that never, ever made it on that paper, because in my mind, I'm like, this is coming with me to the grave. And so what happened this past year is that I started to soften somehow. I wasn't looking for that, quite frankly, but that's clearly what God had for me. And so as I was softening just a little bit, and I was finally, like, I had been here long enough to really, like, let people be sweet to me and, like, receive that. And then I spent a lot of time down in Atlanta where my sponsor is, more than usual, because I think something in me knew that I needed that. I needed to be around my sponsor. I needed to be around my people. My whole recovery, like the strongest part of my recovery network, is in Atlanta. So I spent a lot of time there, and something started cracking open. Oh, sort of a significant thing that I forgot. 5 years ago, roughly, we were living in New Mexico. My husband had a really bad workplace injury and broke his neck and back. My mom still lived in Virginia, my brother. And so something in me was like, go home now. Like, go home now. And I was like, that's crazy, but okay. So I moved back with him to Virginia. And we spent a year there. He was, you know, bedridden. And you know what's interesting about that is that it was the same powerlessness that I had felt when he was actively drinking, and like the alcoholism was bigger than me. This physical incapacity that he was suffering from, that clearly was not his choice and clearly he had no control over. I was that feeling of powerlessness in me that I couldn't fix it or make it better or make him better. Brought the same anger, the same resentment out of nowhere that I had felt all those years ago. And so I was, you know, I dipped my toe right back into that crazy town where I was like, get out of bed. Like, I would yell at him, like, get out of bed. Like, who does that? You know, so like, you know, it's for me, it's like the disease of alcoholism as a family member is really that powerlessness produces a level of rage that then gets misplaced and directed at the person. That person is not a bad person. That person is not a crappy person. That person is a sick person, whether they're an alcoholic, a drug addict, or have some other physical ailment, like a broken back and neck or whatever, cancer. It doesn't matter. Like, that person's sick, not bad. And so it was a real eye-opener for me. I was like, wow, as far as I thought I had come, like, that powerlessness is intense and what it produces in me still. So I got to work through that and, like, make my amends for a lot of what went on there. And in the middle of all of that, my mom went in for heart surgery and didn't come out of the operating room. And you know, I mean, thank God I had that still small voice tell me, go back now. I didn't know at the time why, but that's why, because I had a whole year with her and I got to make a lot of amends and I got to be a really sweet daughter in a way that I'd never been able to do. And unlike for most of my life, I didn't need her to be someone she wasn't. I didn't need her to be able to say I love you, because she couldn't. I could just love on her right where she was and just be sweet and enjoy a lot of great memories with her for a whole year that I didn't know was going to be the last year I'd have with her. So all of that happened. So that's probably, now that I'm talking about, that's what started to crack this whole shell thing open. But I'm a really strong-willed person. And I was scared. I was scared to be cracked open. I was scared to be vulnerable. I was scared to let you really see me. And so, you know, I danced around that extensively for a long time. And, you know, again, he provided great cover because he had such need and his, you know, physical rehabilitation, and he also had a brain injury. Like, that took a lot of focus and energy, and it was a great cover, again, for me. This time it wasn't all craziness. This was like, you know, everybody knew this was a serious situation, but, and that it wasn't his fault, unlike, you know, alcoholism, apparently. But it took, again, the focus off of me and taking care of myself and, you know, really showing up for my own self and doing the things that I needed to do to stay spiritually connected to my God. And, you know, the one thing I will say about, you know, my relationship with God today is I think of it more as the God of my experience versus the God of my understanding. Because if I'm like, my first sponsor called me Little Freud, because she's like, you lady should not be thinking. Like, you should just not, you will analyze the thing to death. So please do not think. And I was like, well, how's that, you know, how's that work, lady? She's like, just don't. Like, don't think so hard. Don't try and figure it out. Like, just go with it. And I'm like, I couldn't wrap my head around what she was trying to say and how I would do that. So you know, so when I think of like the God of my understanding, that's like dangerous territory, because I'll start thinking about, well, what is God at all? You know, I'll work myself into a major frenzy about how do I understand God and like what does it all mean. And so instead, like, I heard a speaker this summer describe her relationship as with a God of her experience. And I'm like, you know what? I really like that. I'm going to borrow that for a minute. Because, like, a great example is yesterday as we were coming, making our way over here from Virginia and Georgia, met up in Fort Lauderdale. You know, we're like sort of walking through the airport, chatting, like, yeah, whatever. And we get to the car rental place, and the car rental guy's like, oh, you know, we don't have the car you reserved. And we're like, he's like, you know, give me a minute. And we're just like chatting. I'm not paying any attention. Now, that's a miracle. Because I'd be like, what? You don't have my car? Like, you know, what? This is not right. You know, but I didn't do anything. Because I'm like, I'm with my friend. I love my friend. I'm like so happy to see my friend. And like, yeah, whatever. We'll have a car. Whatever. I just need to have four wheels and move. Like, I don't really care what kind of car it is. So we're like, blah, blah, blah. And then next thing he goes, well, we have a car. How much luggage do you have? And I'm like, well, not much, because, you know, we overpacked, but not, you know, with bags, just what's in the bags. But anyway, so he goes, well, you know, I got this car. He shows me a picture. It's this, like, super fabulous convertible with, like, no back seat. And I'm like, yes, let's take the car. Zooming off and, you know. But that's, like, a little mini example of the God of my experience. If I just chill out and go with the flow and not get too bogged down in the details, and my rights are that it should be this car, I might actually get something really fabulous that I wasn't even looking for. Because I did ask him, like, is that going to cost me more? And he's like, no. I'm like, all right, well, yeah, bring it on. So, you know, so that's kind of like how this whole trip is. Then we're like sitting at lunch, and some guy I know from New York who's a really dear friend, like, is standing there. And I'm like, what? So, like, you know, I got to, like, have a big hug and see his wife and his kids, and she's now pregnant, and it was like this fabulous thing. I wasn't looking for that. Like, who knew, right? So that's the God of my experience, and it can be with the littlest of things and the biggest of things. But if I just, like, let go, which is really, really hard, and my first thought that's always the bad thought, or the thought of, like, how can I fix it? How can I control it? If I just let that thought go and wait for the second or third thought to appear, chances are it's going to go really, really well. One way or the other, it's going anyway. And I can either be kicking and screaming, or I can just let it flow. So that's kind of like the God of my experience today. And, you know, so I spent this whole year really, like, softening. And I will say this, I'm jumping all over the place, but it was like 2017. I had a moment where, you know, I live in a small town in Virginia. And in my mind, I'm like, this is so not my place. I mean, I need to be in a big city, you know, and fabulousness. And so I was like, sponsor, I need to move. I need to get an important job, and, you know, like, whatever. That was my ego talking. And she was like, okay, well, here, do a writing assignment. Oh, okay, fine. So I did the writing assignment. Before I read it to her, I was like, just so you know, I did the writing assignment, and I know what it says. I'm going to do it anyway. Because I knew the writing assignment clearly said, don't do it. And I was like, just a fair warning, I'm going to do it anyway. And she was like, okay. So I, you know, we have that chat, and I told her that, and she just went, uh-huh, okay. Love that about her. And then, but the weirdest thing happened. I didn't do the thing. I just sat there, in a good way, and I just didn't move. Like, I didn't spring into action. I didn't make a project. I didn't go move to another place. I didn't go get busy trying to, like, externally fix what was clearly not okay with me on the inside. So I just, metaphorically speaking, I just sat there. And what I didn't realize that in doing that, I was letting God actually work on me. And God's been kind of like, you know, working on me for the last almost 3 years. And right now I'm in a really big transition. I didn't anticipate, didn't see coming. And I'm just going to continue to sit in it. I'm just going to let the car rental guy give me a fantastic, sporty race car with a convertible top. I'm going to let my friends just pop out of nowhere while I'm having lunch in, you know, Deerfield Beach. I'm going to visit with my sponsor. I'm going to have my girlfriend come meet me here for the weekend. Hey, let's go to Florida. Yeah, you know. I'm going to, like, just do whatever's happening right in front of me. I'm not going to get too worked up over it because I have no idea what this is going to look like. I have no idea. But what I do know is that I'm soft. And the people who are in my life who mean the most to me, they see it. And they say it to me. They're like, oh, you're so soft. And I'm like, and I don't cringe when they say it. I don't go, oh, you know, shut up. No, I'm hard and tough, you know. No, I'm like, oh, thanks. I want to close with something I wrote that I sent to my sponsor a few weeks ago. And she said, oh, I think you should read that when you give your... when you tell your story. I'm like, okay, sponsor direction. I do always follow it. So I'm going to just read that. Al-Anon, a love story. When I came to Al-Anon, I didn't think I was walking into a love story. In fact, if you had told me that, I would have turned around and left. I couldn't even let you hug me. But I kept coming back, and you said, we'll love you until you love yourself. Okay, whatever. But I kept coming back, and you said, get a sponsor, get a home group, work the steps, and pray. Oh, well, where else can I go? This is it, last stop on the train. But I kept coming back, and you said, you're not done until you're done. Yeah, not done. But I kept coming back, and you said, live and let live, detach with love, and do the next right thing. Huh? What does that look like? But I kept coming back. Eventually, I got that there was a love story, and I decided it was with him. So I kept coming back, and you said, watch how we live in our homes. Sure, I'll do anything at this point. So I kept coming back. And yet I still wasn't happy, and I still felt alone. Now I decided the love story was out in the world, the job, my family, people around me. So I kept coming back, and you said, let's study the 12 traditions and practice these principles in all our affairs. Why not? Everything else worked so far. So I kept coming back, and you said, stay in the middle, get honest, and help others. I could do two of the three. While I kept coming back, I also kept secrets. I hid from you, and I stopped letting you in. I was scared, and I couldn't see it or admit it. And now that I wanted you to love me, I thought if you knew, you might not. But I kept coming back, and you simply said, I love you. A lot. And the edges softened. I let God in more and more and walked through loss, grief, fear, and other people's stuff. And despite my first thought to run, I stayed. I stayed and I let God work on me. Finally, I could say to each of you, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. And then you all said it back. My heart cracked and I was free. And it turns out the love story is with me. Thank you very much.